maybe the main Rosh Hashanah prayer, Le'el Orech Din, the one that says that we are each examined, like we're a flock, and God is the shepherd. And during these 10 days of awe, that each of us is pulled aside and individually examined, each sheep, we're each a sheep. And then we that's where the judgment is made, whether it's going to be, you know, or maybe not exactly that moment, but the idea is that we're being judged, we're being evaluated, we're being looked at one-on-one by God. So I wanted to bring that back for a moment to whether anyone had ideas about how that relates to the notion of prophecy that we were discussing. The prophet feels what the universe is feeling. The prophet speaks for the way in which God wants society to move forward, like a new paradigm for society, a new paradigm for Israel. So the prophet has very much a social message and a social conscience. And finally, in a way, the prophet is the one who brings to us the notion that God is primarily judging the collective Israelite people, the society. And this is different than, well, like the rabbi, or I mean, that's a later figure. I'm trying to figure out. The prophet is the one that communicates, like, you know, people talk today about, well, Ezekiel's sermons and Jeremiah gave sermons. I mean, that these are, because we talked about, they're not exactly oracles. They are like public declarations. But one of the ways they're different than a sermon, maybe, is that sermon implies, like, I'm trying to speak to Naomi, what Naomi's going through in her life right now. I'm trying to speak to Ruth about what's going on in her life. A sermon's supposed to, like, try to connect you to God individually, but the prophet speaks about the experience of Israel. Israel is like a suffering servant. He's like the servant that watches the master's house, which has been demolished and destroyed, and the master's nowhere to be seen. And that servant stands there at the broken door, and when people go by, says, you can't come in here, and you know, like, I'm watching it for when the master gets back. I mean, that's all of 2nd Isaiah. It goes on for 20 chapters about the suffering servant. And then we all know, what do Christians say the suffering servant is? It's Jesus, because Jesus was a servant who suffered. So clearly, 20 chapters about Jesus, and those who came to the session I did during the summer, they just don't like to look at the beginning of this whole succession where it got over and over. What does 2nd Isaiah say? The suffering servant is the Israel. The suffering servant is the people of Israel, whose country has been destroyed. And they are like, even though they are in exile, they are the suffering servant who everyone makes fun of. Like, your home was destroyed. Your master doesn't exist. And they stand by and say, I am not going to become Babylonian. I'm not going to become Akkadian. I'm not going to become Assyrian. I am waiting for the master return, even as everyone mocks them for the fact that the house is in a shambles, right? Sherman's march came right through. There's no it reminds me of the end of Gone with the Wind, right? I mean, there are not too many drapes to make more dresses out of. Like, we're all just laughing at your Tara, and they're like, I'm going to stand with Tara. Okay, forget it. I'm not getting anywhere with Tara. So we'll go back. So if the prophet is calling us out in the sense that judgment, when we are evaluated in Judaism, we are basically evaluated collectively. We are looked upon as a group. What are the Jews, when God sees the whole people, God doesn't just say, well, they're the winners and the losers. And then we get to Le'o Orech Din, and it is different. So this is my question to you. We're about to get to Rosh Hashanah, where God's the shepherd, we're the flock, and for one, like, moment a year, right, for the 10-day period of the days of awe between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we're all, like it says, what does the El Orech Din, the prayer say? Each sheep is pulled out for a little bit. You know, it's like counting sheep. And you have your moment before God, and God evaluates you. And that does go counter to the notion that of the Hebrew Bible, which is that God's looking down upon the collective. As I often say, maybe too often for your taste, God's looking down at the anthill, not at the ants. And that's just simply it. I mean, God's like, how's that anthill working? Wait a second, I'm hearing the screams of the poor, the screams of the women. They look like they're mostly just consuming the resource of the land. I better add in some more laws about, like, preserving nature. I hear the animals are overburdened. I see people taken in war as slaves, even though I said no slaves. Like, it's kind of looking at how the anthill is working, kind of like Einstein was saying, you know, how does the universe work? And it's God doesn't be like, I don't know about that ant with the kippah that Alex is wearing. I don't know about that Alex ant. Alex, you and I got to have a talk. Like, that's not the way it works. It's not the examination we undergo, except in this prayer. So can anyone help me make sense before we do the prayer on Rosh Hashanah and everything? Le'ol Ruach Din, the big one. And it says, God brings, it says, we each brought in front of God, and God figures out the decree, who shall live and who shall die. And it's only through tshuva, getting back on your path with God, get tzedakah, acts of good deeds, and tefillah, introspection, that, you know, you can avert the severity of the divine decree. So that kind of goes against our religion. Can anyone try to make it compatible, or do you want to say, I can't, solve this? And that is very much the image for, but that's what Yom Kippur is supposed to be. I mean, it's supposed to be that leading up to Yom Kippur, you've made peace with your fellow man, right? The sins, I'm sorry, the mistakes or the sins between man and man, between human being and human being, are supposed to all be taken care of prior to Kol Nidre, prior to Yom Kippur beginning. And then, so what is 25 hours of tefillah? What's 25 hours of introspection? It's supposed to be, in a way, like taking care of your affairs on earth before you die, so that you can then, in a way, be ready. Like, in a way, feel like, well, if I'm lucky enough to get extra time, if this isn't my year to die, how would I live? So tefillah is not, please God, don't kill me this year, don't write me into the book of death. It's more this process of putting on the white, which symbolizes the white shrouds of death. The sources for wearing white on Yom Kippur are the being wrapped in white shrouds when you die, and also the idea that angels are somehow made up of white light, that our purity is in the whiteness of our light, and our soul is considered to be tahora. We say a vidui to say that we know that deep down inside our soul is made up of a white light. So the white, but it's a deathbed preparation. If I could live without guilt, if I could live with an acceptance of gratitude in my life, if I could just live as if every day is, I'm exactly where I want to be with God and everything. That's what 25 hours of introspection is about. And so you get your moment with God to say, well, how have I been that way? And anybody else in terms of, you know, the sheep and the... I think so. I mean, I think that even though it's the exception, or it's something of the exception, to be this moment of individual connection with God in a religion that really places a lot of emphasis on the society moving forward, you know, the society whether it's a safe and healthy society, you know, and a society that is lifting up all of its members and going to the next evolutionary step. But in this moment, even though you're an individual sheep, you're still a member of the flock. So in a way, if the notion is when God's looking at the anthill, that maybe Alex and Nareed are doing all of this work of spreading this positive energy in these 100 mitzvahs, right? Like, they're not big on the other 513, but these 100 mitzvahs, they're bringing all this positive energy to the world and channeling it. And then Naomi and Anya, right, they got their 100 mitzvahs, the rest they're not that into, right? And they're channeling that. Now, when you look, and that's true for all of us. So, now when God looks at the anthill, God's like, cool. You know, God's like, that stuff's getting done, that stuff's getting done. Everyone's playing their part. And that's one of the reasons that on Kol Nidre we get together, because we realize we're not doing it alone. You know, one person may be incredible, like totally lifting up the society and taking us forward in one way, but, you know, they're really not bringing positive energy in terms of the suffering of animals on this earth. Or they're really bringing great Torah and Torah study and this learning, but they're really not good with people. And they are leaving. There are people who are popping up on the anthill that need help, and they're just deaf to the voices. And we all know that we can't do every mitzvah. There's just not time in the day. And we don't have those gifts. You know what I mean? You can't make, I mean, I've met people who say, I sat in Torah study for 10 years and I didn't get anything out of it at my other synagogue. And I'd love to say you'll get out of it with me, but maybe that's just not your gift. You know what I mean? Like, that's never going to work. I made Shabbos and made my kids sit around that table and I made them shut up while I blessed them and I made them eat that challah. I've met people like this. You know what I mean? I did my job and my kids hate Judaism. And I'm like, maybe you should have been doing a different mitzvah. You know what I mean? Like,
you're off the derech.
They're off the derech. It's like, what did I do? I forced them to go to yeshiva, and we took out three more to just send them to Jewish private school, and where they were bullied by the rich kids. I mean, these are true stories, you know what I mean? So now they just hate Judaism, because they're like, clearly those schools only care about the rich donors. So, and I'm like, that's not true, because I've been on those boards, they're amazing. So like, but, you know, it's like, so I'm like, oh my gosh, like, they're like, but Rabbi, so I'm like, we can't do all of them. So, and we don't have those gifts. Some of us are clay, some of us are cloth, some of us are iron. We're all in the hands of the potter, and we're all different materials, and we're all trying to figure out how do we shape ourselves to be a great part of the anthill, to be doing the things that we're gifted in doing, because that makes us feel free, right? If Shelley is like this incredible musician, and I'm like, you got to play jazz. I need the jazz. And Shelley's like, oh, well, I mean, I'm really great at, like, blues, but, okay, you're telling me to be a good Jew, I need to play jazz. You know, that's not going to probably work too well. So we got to know who we are. Are we the jazz? Are we the rock? Are we the something else? Are we the tone deaf? We should be, like, reading the poetry in English and not singing it. So normally the goal is to, like, that we're God's looking at the anthill because we need all of us on board to do our jobs and it create a harmony that takes us all forward. But in that moment, that 10 days a year, I do think in some ways, at least for me, God's saying, okay, number one, do you even know like what your job is in the flock, right? Are you being harmonious or are you hitting your head against the wall? You know, are you the one I'm always having to run after because you don't know who you are? You know, because that's really busy for the shepherd. The shepherd wants everyone to be like, you know, in sync. Are you the one that's always creating problems with the other people in the herd? You know, like, how do you get that noise that, how do we work on you? And I also think for me, I think a couple, like at least a day a year, I should be challenged on the things I'm not doing. Like, I think that's super awesome that you sing in the choir. But you did see, you know, that movie about the way meat is made, and you don't seem to care. Like, that, you know, because, I mean, you know, you really love your veal, you know, like, but you did see that movie. So are you, like, cool with that? Are you sure? You know, the rabbi did beg you to do this thing, and you were kind of like, I don't like going to services. If there's going to be a prayer, I'm not going to be anywhere to be found. And, like, I understand prayer can't be your main thing. You'd be hitting your head against the wall. But, like, you know, maybe now and then. I mean, so, like, the idea that, like, there is a little bit, like, I understand you're an individual, and I love you and I respect you, but you're still part of the flock. Are you being a good part of the flock? Because you and I, you're the one that I'm always chasing after. Like, you know, like, you still have a role to play. So it doesn't mean there's no social component at all. It's kind of asking, like, are we a good Jew? Are we a good member of the people? Are we a good member of the society? Or are we mostly self-centered? It could be like, you know, you're always the one that wants to stay back and eat those weeds when we've all moved on to the next thing. You know what I mean? Like, at some point, we have a responsibility to be a good part of society. What you shouldn't be thinking when it says, you know, for the sin of gluttony, and you know that you're not a glutton, right? So you shouldn't be saying, like, what a stupid list. This is why I'm a millennial and I will never show up to synagogue again, right? Because, like, I'm not a glutton. Why is it saying that I say I'm a glutton? So why are you saying that? If you're not, let's just say you're not. So why would you stand there and go like that, Nuri? Well, I mean, like, if you're part of the flock, if you're part of the flock and there are gluttons in the flock, yeah, then, like, again, it goes back to the fact that we do not think collectively in modern culture. We really, really, really don't. And part of this is, not trying to be too controversial, I feel like I've become the anti-Christian rabbi, and I'm probably the only rabbi in America with a master's degree in Christian theology hanging on my wall. So, like, this is, like, a very strange thing. Yeah, that's right. Thank you, Shelley. I feel better already. Let me let her rip. So I'll just say that the church did very much bring to the society that we inherited or we're in America a notion of individual salvation. And there's something incredibly powerful about it, And there's a lot of tremendously, I mean, you know, I when I got a master's in it, if I didn't like reading it, there's a lot of love, there's a lot of psychological release, and there's a lot of beauty in it. But the dark side is that you could, and there's dark side in Judaism too, but the dark side there is that people try to save their own soul. And in Judaism, it's not a step you can take. You can't separate yourself from the people in that way. And when you stand there and you say, why am I saying this? I'm not a glutton. It is the ultimate Jewish sin to say, like, but we're all in it together. We're part of the anthill. You know what I mean? So it's like, you know, so if there are sexists on the anthill, you may not be a sexist, but you got to be like, we need to do better. It's just, but we don't think that way. Like, I mean, Americans don't think that way. They don't think like we're all in it together. We're part of a body politic.
That's communism.
Right? I mean, it really is the idea that, like, it doesn't matter if the finger says, well, I'm a glutton, because you're part of the same body that has a mouth. You know what I mean? Like, you are part of it. And the idea that you're seeking your own salvation and not the salvation of all of us just goes against Torah. I mean, isn't it weird psychologically that one of the beauties of getting older, for real, I mean, I just feel like Judaism is a religion that is celebrating growing up. It's celebrating maturity. It views the release from the Garden of Eden as a growing up of humanity. Like we celebrate wisdom and getting older. One of the great things about getting older for me is, I mentioned it last night at Slichot, about dropping your filter a little bit. And part of dropping your filter is also dropping your shame. You know what I mean? Like, you know, dropping the things that you've been shamed of during your life and you internalized, and then realizing, I don't care. I mean, I grew up in a congregation. I wasn't close with my extended family in Philadelphia, even though they all lived there. But I did not come from a loving extended family. So we kept our distance and had healthy boundaries. So my bar mitzvah, even though all my relatives lived around, they didn't come. And so I gave away the honors to the people in the congregation. And the first people, and they were all the older folks who came to services, and you know, and because they were more my family in some ways. I'd come to services with my dad, and those are, you know, I knew the, over here would have been, you know, the Beth Ozers and the Molly Cohens, and now, you know, the Ray Harveys and the you know, Jack Frank, and the people who are there. So anyway. But two of them were like, two women that lived together. So, you know, our mitzvahs in the 70s, you know, and I'm like, oh yeah, they're just roommates, you know. And they had like the big Kohen Aliyah and stuff like that. And I wonder if two people who are gay, in a time when that was completely shamed, like, I hope they got to the point as they got older where they said, you know, like, we're dropping all of the judgment from society. We don't care what people think. Part of getting older is dropping the shame. And I only connect that back to the list, which is, yes, when I was younger, I was like, what's wanton glances? And I'm not a glutton. And I don't tell tales. Now that I'm older, I'm all like, I totally do. I do all of this stuff. You know what I mean? Just like you're saying, which is like, I'm like, and it's not like, oh my God, you know, I need to buy a ticket into heaven because I'm so terrible. It's different. It's like, it's not heavy. You know, it's like, of course I do wants and glances, and I'm probably the most happily married man on earth. And yet, like, I don't indulge myself in wants and glances, but I mean, like, we're surrounded by a society that's, I can't log on to my Yahoo page without these pictures of Taylor Swift and models and Hadid and Kardashian and stuff like that. And I don't dwell on them, but I still sometimes look like, wow, she's got a big bottom. You know, I mean, like, I think that's a wants and glance, you know? I'm like, that's like the eighth wonder of the world, you know? I think so, you know, I'm like going over this list. I'm like, I do do all of this. And we don't
it's
tell
talk. It's not a wonder, it's an implant.
Right. So you're guilty too.
Surgical wonder.
Right, and like, you know, and gossip. I used to think of like, you know, two people spreading gossip. Of course we gossip. Of course, I mean, once you understand what gossip is, talking about people who aren't around. We all talk about people who aren't around. You know, so Marie, I love it. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at.
Awkward.
Or I am. No, but one of the reasons it's like, it is this weird paradox.
Yeah.
But it is the coolest paradox ever, because in a way, what it's saying is, and Sarah said it really beautifully, so I got to give you credit. No, but it's like, what if you dropped all the negative guilt that's holding you down? So you accept yourself, And then you see yourself more fully, and you realize I'm a lot like everybody else, but I also want to work on all of this. Like, rather than, look, Rabbi, give me a break. I volunteer at JFS. You know, I'm doing my mitzvah, and so I'm not doing, like you say, Rabbi, we can't do all the mitzvahs. We'd be busy every day. Your mitzvah is you do Torah study. My mitzvah is I work at JFS. You know, but then when we, on Yom Kippur, it's a little different. Because we read over all these things, like Sarah said, and we're like, I do all these things, you know? And today I don't give myself a pass about it. But, so I don't, it's that irony you just pointed out. You don't give yourself a pass, but you're also self-accepting. Like, how does that work? But that, you know, you're on your deathbed, and you didn't realize, you know, the doctor says you have 8 months, and it's a week later, and it's not looking good, and your blood pressure's dropping, and you're there, and the rabbi comes to visit you, and you're like, uh-oh. And, and you know, and basically I'm like, look, accept that you did the best that you could. Accept that, it's weird, the vidui, the confessional, which is completely connected thematically to the confessional we do on Yom Kippur, is, it is paradoxical. It's that, I totally messed up. Like, I've let... Well, I mean, what you say in the confessional. God, I have let others down, I've let you down, and I've let myself down. So you start off with that. Like, I've let us all down. But then it's also like, but I know that I did the work I could do in this world, and along the way I did some damage. And I see it for what it is. Like, I really wasn't there for the way my daughter really, really needed me. And you're also letting it go, like you don't stand up there like the all powerful King Lear, and you're like, I did the best I could, and the way I raised you was the best for all of you. You know, like, which is, that's an act of power. That's an act of hubris. It's the act of saying it was all for your own good. But on the deathbed, and I'm with people all the time in this position. It's like, I really was deeply imperfect. And yet, like, that gives me a peace to understand that, and an appreciation of what I did do. And you're also saying, like, I could have done more work. I wish God would give me more time so that I could do more work in the world. But I want to go, Diana. And I love the fact that that's what you're doing up to Yom Kippur. I mean, this idea that you fix your relationships, or it's not fix them, you make peace with them. And then, but then you work on yourself. I mean, I really do think that when we say the three paths to averting the severity of the divine decree are tzedakah, tefillah, and teshuva. And teshuva means getting back on the path that you need to be walking with God. As I said last night, forget about all the things people have ever said about you married the wrong person, you moved to the wrong city, you chose the wrong career, you didn't finish your degree, you bought real estate at the wrong time, whatever it is, you know, you drink too much. It's like, whatever it is that, if you let all that go, so that you can hear the voice of God to say, what's your next step from where you are now? Like, all you can do is turn to the path before you. Doesn't matter about what happened before. Saul, and then...
So this is the time
I also think we're a lot in denial. Like, I'm not a glutton, I'm not a this, yeah, I'm not a that. So, like, there's also, like, I think we're pretty... many of us are pretty great in our own heads.
As long as we can't, I should strive to do better.
And I think, I mean, yeah, I mean... It can be an incredibly profound holiday. I mean, I feel bad for, you know, when Yom Kippur ends with that long shofar blast at Nila, it's so beautiful, you know. And, you know, you can see there are all these people who are like, yeah, so you slam Trump in your sermon, and I bet you're going to ruffle some feathers. And I'm like, you're not in the same Yom Kippur as I'm in Yom Kippur. You know what I mean? Like, and then you see those people. Like, people come up to me, and they're like, you know, like, I'm floating on air. That was beautiful. And it doesn't necessarily mean me. It could be in Sharna. It could be anything. It could be the sun. Look, I can't even compete with the sunset. You know, half the people are like, that was a beautiful Yom Kippur. And I'm like, thank you very much. I'll take a bow. And they're like, it was all the sunset. You should have seen the moon rise behind in the window above you. And I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. Yes, the moon. Yes, take a bow. Yeah. And I just mean, like, it could be anything. But it's this moment of, like, I love the image you gave of your father, and I appreciate you actually bringing it up, which is, it isn't saying, this is who I am. I did the best I could. Do you know what I mean? Like, take me as I am. Like, we are all able to change our path a little bit. Yeah. So rather than going with the normal thing during the year, like, I do the Torah study, I don't do the help people, or I do this, or I'm a cultural Jew, or I'm a this, I know who I am, blah, blah, blah. It's the one time a year you're like, God, 10 days. And then that 25-hour ending of saying, you know, my story is not written. Can you imagine the person on the deathbed, you know, being told, wow, blood pressure's back up. I think you do have 8 months left. You may even have more. Maybe you go into remission to say, wow, I went through that process of saying, I know I'm imperfect, and I totally accept that, and I let it go in a way, but I also realized that, like, I can live differently now. I mean, I could, what if I lived every day like I did when the rabbi was sitting with me, praying with me, you know, where I was kind of like, I can now tell my kids, I really did let you down, you know, like, I didn't. None of us are doing the best we can. It's interesting that we do that right when, like, we're supposed to be like, this is our moment with God evaluating us, which is also like, wow, that would be pretty chutzpahdik to be like, hey, check out the sheep, you know, like, I'm like, high five God, you know. It should be more like, oh, sorry, I could do better. I want to go nuri, but I just want to say one thing, which is like, when a high holidays, when often I think, I forget which prayer it is when Sharna's chanting it, and I'm praying and I'm thinking about my father-in-law. And who lives nearby, and we moved him here, and I think about the day, because we're off the texting, the day I took away his car, and that's a hard thing to do. And I remember I talked to him, he said, look, I mean, when I showed up in Denver, he lives alone, he has no help, and he's been driving, you know, like, to get groceries, get to the doctor, and so he's like, this is sudden. You know, it's pretty sudden, just be like, you're putting the car on Craigslist and you're taking away the keys. And, you know, and because he's like, I obviously can drive, there are groceries in the fridge, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I told him, I said, how would you feel if you hit somebody coming home from the grocery store? A child, a pedestrian. And I said, I'm not saying you will, but I'm saying you know yourself. Is that possible, considering the way, you don't have to even tell me, like, just where you're at driving, and, you know, instead of saying, like, I don't know what you're implying, I'm a better driver than you, right, the kind of, like, how dare you impugn my whatever, my ego, he said, yeah, put up. So I sold on Craigslist in an hour, and but isn't that, what I'm saying is, I pray that on Yom Kippur because it comes up, because it's this idea of collective responsibility, which is, it's not just like, it's not all about me and my texting, right? The reason not to text is not that texting's a bad habit while you're driving. It's that, like, God's more worried about you killing somebody than you hurting yourself. I don't think a lot of people get that. I don't even think I get that a lot. I mean, we're moving around in the world. We're kind of self-involved, like, you know? And that's why God's kind of like, not like, oh, yeah, let me join, you know? I mean, and you know why I can't stand the way people talk about God, because they're like, yeah, you know, while I was, you know, God made it a nice day for me because it's my kid's birthday party, and God did this. And I'm like, whoa, that's exactly the opposite of the consciousness we as Jews really have. Like, God's not like, I think right now I will inhabit the consciousness of Naomi Lender. You know, I will inhabit that ant. I just want to spend my day with that ant. You know, because that ant's so incredible. You know, and they're having a birthday party today. You know, like, God's not that God. Like, God's like, wow, that ant is on a car that's going astray, and there are kids in the other cars. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what God is thinking. That's what the prophet is saying, you know? And so it's like saying, you can change because there's suffering that you're a part of. Thank you very much, Holly, and we'll talk to you soon. Have a safe trip to the airport. And Nuri.
Does that put that totally off?
I mean, someone might say, but Rabbi, isn't that what all services are about? And I'm like, not exactly. Do you know what I mean? Like, for those who come to services, yes and no. I mean, you know, there's something different about Yom Kippur. I mean, in a normal prayer davening, when I'm praying, just to put it super, super duper simply, one of those simple formulas I crib it from Heschel and change it a little bit, is that at the very least what I'm doing in a normal prayer, in a normal service or cycle of prayers, is to try to take the moments of connection to God and to connection to nature and connection to myself, my best moments of religious experience or whatever, touching on the ineffable, my greatest insights, Heschel calls, trying to take my past greatest moments of insight and using them to refresh my memory about them and using them as a way of guiding my behavior for that day or for that week. So that, you know, it's not about having a religious experience during prayer. It's about having a time that you set aside to summon back your best moments, the moments that called with them responsibility, and to use those to now guide your behavior for a day, an hour, a couple of days. That's the whole point. I mean, that's for morning davening. It's like, so if one of your moments of insight was a case where you were cheated in business, or you know that your competitor is beating you because they're doing something that is unsafe to the public welfare, and one of your moments of insight in the world was, I will never be that business, then you daven before you go to work. You know, you go to 7 a.m. davening, and that's one of the things you're thinking when you're davening the Amidah, where, you know, it says fairness and justice is what God's demanding of you all the time. And you hold to that. You're like, I'm not going to fall to that level of cheating as a business and taking chances because that's not who I am. Or it could be connection to nature and you're concerned, like, I'm going to go out and again, you know, I may really want to do this and that, but I'm going to preserve the environment because of how much I love nature, because of those hikes, camping with my dad when I was a kid. Or, so you're taking your past moments that when you did them, you're like, this is teaching me something. Or moments of people, you know, the mourner's Kaddish, people who touched you and showed you a way to live. And by remembering them, it changes your behavior. So on one hand, prayer is about that. And there's something different for me about Yom Kippur, which is, it's like, if you have really made peace with the people in your life for all of the month of Elul, and then the final stretch, if you haven't done it yet, Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, then it's an incredibly, like, we don't do that every week. It's incredibly powerful to have 25 hours of introspection, of just you and God, of just what's your next step, of just who are you really, of just, letting go a lot of the baggage we carry around, but then saying, okay, now that I'm more fleet of foot, where am I going? What am I capable of? What can I try to take on? And you can make New Year's resolutions, and you can fail, you know, but you can say, like, but I feel like taking this on, you know, I can take on Torah study, what are New Year's resolutions? I can only drink once a week instead of every night a week. I can do this. Like, you're the person who's like, okay, you thought you only had, you know, Leo Orachdin, you may only have 6 months to live, you may have 60 years to live. Okay, it shouldn't make any difference either way. For like how empowered you should get up and hit the ground running, you know. And so, let me read you one thing, which is, so we were talking about prophecy. I told you last time I'd read the Haftarah to you from Yom Kippur morning. Okay, so we're in the middle of all of this, and then we read from 2nd Isaiah. And 2nd Isaiah says, Kra Begaron. Okay, so call out with a full throat, with a full gut, garon, from your throat, full throat. Cry with a full throat, without restraint. Raise your voice like a shofar. So make your voice a shofar. And declare to my people their transgression. Let me see what the Hebrew, you know, there are three words for transgression. This is pisham. So this is not sin, and this is not, I usually use transgression for avon, which means doing things, you breaking rules because you want to, because there's gain. There's food at the end, there's chocolate, there's money, there is enjoyment, there's pleasure. But so you did it, you felt good, but you broke a rule. That's avon. So it's a conscious sin, but it's a sin for benefit. But this is a pisham. This is a pesha, which is the sin that you do out of ego. Right, so I again, for those who study a lot with me, I'm sorry I use the same examples over and over. I apologize. They're just the ones that come to me. One of them is, it's the teenager who actually isn't having a great time with their friends, but comes home late anyway, just to show their parents that their parents don't make the rules. That's a pesha. It's usually translated a rebellious sin. I call it a sin of ego because it's personal. You didn't actually benefit, but you did it consciously. And here, a lot of Jews do that. Hey, Max, I mean, you know, if I had a dollar, for every Jew who's like, I'm not religious, I'm not like that. Like, to me, it's not even like, it's almost just like, you don't have anything to teach us. My tradition has nothing to guide me. You know, like, so anyway, this is the sin of not seizing hold of Yom Kippur, of seizing hold of these processes, but saying it's for someone else, right? It's like, yeah, you know, I saw Food Inc., but I like my cheeseburger. It's like, that's for someone else. Like, forget you. It's like somehow saying the rules don't apply. I'm doing the best I can, and it's pretty darn good. You know, like, I mean, no, because the person I love most in the world, you know, once confronted, you know, on many occasions confronted a parent who had wronged them in a way. And the parent's response is, I did the best I could. And I totally can see both sides of it. I totally see that parent. I think I have it in me, too, to say that. You know what I mean? Rabbi, you really let me down with High Holy Days. It didn't work for me. And I think I really have that wave in my way. I say, hey, try another synagogue. Why don't you go down the street and see what you think there? You know, like, in other words, I have it in me, too, to be like, I did the best I could, and it was pretty darn good, and if you have a problem, I suggest you go and have your prayers with God and work it on out. You know, like, we all have it in us, you know, and you know what I mean? And you're like, you know, and, well, to me, I think, I mean, I think the proper response is simple. I think that it's to find that place in yourself where you can honestly say, without malice or fakery, just to say, you're probably right. I'm sorry.
When we read any of the confessional lists and we don't see ourselves in the ones that we don't see ourselves in, we are consciously or unconsciously separating ourselves from the community and from others. And it's an act of ego. All right, the idea that I'm not a glutton and I don't do wanton glances and I don't gossip. Or the list that we use in our synagogue that I wrote, that I don't share adult information with a child. I don't use my children that way to be friends rather than my children. I don't try to make them happy because that's easier than trying to make them good or to lead them to independence. It's the ego jumping in that creates that division, not our soul, not a spirituality. And I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, just thinking of High Holy Days themselves. Every cantor knows someone's going to walk up to them and say, "You should have heard the way my cantor used to do Kol Nidre." By implying that was a lot better than your Kol Nidre. I remember one of the greatest sermons I thought I ever gave. Someone made an appointment with me to tell me that they just couldn't believe I could talk about that topic on High Holy Days. It was so irrelevant. It was so un-Jewish. It was their worst High Holidays ever. And in a way, it's almost like me sitting there with a sin list, a confessional list, and saying, "You're crazy." You know, like, in other words, I'm not guilty of the sin that you're accusing me of. All right? That was a great sermon, in fact. I have emails to prove it, and incredibly selfish of you to think that the sermon that you needed to hear, the Kol Nidre you needed to hear, was the one we all needed to hear. And yet, it is the ego that's jumping in to say, I didn't do that sin. The truth is, in a lot of ways, even if I don't take everything the person says as gospel, nevertheless, this person at heart isn't there because they need to hate me. They're there because they need to be close to me, and I let them down. They're not the unaffiliated. They're not the people who think they're too good to go to synagogue. This is actually someone who does go to synagogue. They want a good High Holy Day experience. They want to be close to God. They want that, and they need to tell me that I failed them in that. And in some ways, it's not so different that I'm saying that the person who says, well, I can see the movie Food Inc., or I saw that documentary with Michael Pollan, but I saw that report on how the fast food chains raise their protein, their walking food. And yet, like, I'm not a bad person. I'm doing the best I can. That's not my sin. I mean, or that's a minor sin. It's a little bit like me saying, hey, I give great sermons. You can go to a different synagogue, be my guest, see if you get your needs satisfied any other way, any better. That's a little bit like me saying, you think I'm a gossip? Why don't you go find other people and see what real gossip looks like? That's not my sin. I think that when you understand that finding a bond to the community through a closeness with everyone does go through breaking down your ego and seeing that everyone really does want a closeness. And we're all participating in failing that, whether it's through our ego, through our defensiveness, through not taking any responsibility for the fact that while, yes, we could be doing better, we're not doing the best that we can. We have such a deep-seated need to be right that it trumps our need to be human. I see that in political commentators now and in political positions, because with one very prominent, you know, I'm thinking of two extremely prominent Jewish Republican writers, conservative writers, pundits. And one of them says that though Donald Trump fails every character test he ever set, he himself ever set in his articles and his punditry for the importance of candidates, nevertheless, we all must vote for him because he's still more right than he's wrong, and the principles that this person's radio show and magazine and machine is in favor, we're the heroes, the other people are the enemies, we must defeat the enemy. And I compare that to someone who's one of the leading Republican pundits and who just said, you know, he is going to admit that he's not sure what to say anymore about this election, that he's hit a point where it's too confusing because he thinks that the candidate of his party has said things that are so offensive to his Jewish soul that it goes beyond right and wrong, and heroes and villains. I mean, even here, like, it's not about we are right and they are wrong anymore. It's about what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to have a desire that this is a country in which we can all ever pull together and take ourselves to another level? And in a sense, he's saying, I don't know how to do political punditry right now. You know, and it's not even about vilifying the man per se, because you don't want to play into, I just switch sides. He's like, I'm not switching sides. So what I want to say is even that I saw in this pundit is a desire to say, there's a time to realize being human's more important than being right. And it's a time when you got to put your ego aside about I'm right and you're wrong, or I can't take criticism. I can't see myself in all of those sins that seem foreign. They are not me. This is an ancient and primitive list, or the list Rav Nadav wrote is ancient and primitive in its own new way, or this is all just a bunch of self-hatred and, or something like that. And I don't believe in the negativity, but it's not about that at all. It's about a path for the ego to say, you just called my contribution awful. I see that as a sign to be close. I see in the list of these things that I don't normally even see myself in as doing, I'm a part of that. And even if I'm not perfectly a part of that, I can see myself in it because it brings me closer to everybody. So that is the bridge between the Jewish spirituality, the prophetic spirituality of seeing judgment as corporate and as social, and why we have a special moment now of individual judgment and individual confession, because it's supposed to bring us closer and see that we are more, and break down the ego, and through that introspective path, free the energy of being more powerful together and being more powerful individually. Living in that place of right and wrong, is that place of ego, is constricting. It is not growth. It's the kind of thing that I think that when I spend my time with people in their 90s, they've let go of. You know, like, and it's not like, well, I don't care about politics anymore. They actually are very brilliant things to say about it. It's they've left it behind, the idea that their positions are right and they're in a battle with the others, because what they see is that we're all in it together.
If we are more powerful together, then the one thing we should do is not separate. So, you know, the person's there. The person came to hear Kol Nidre. I totally honor that. Like, how about all the people who aren't there? This is not a rebellious sin. You know what I mean? This is that. If there's any sin in the criticism, it's definitely of the mild chet variety. It's just the unintentional error. It's just the, you know, like, they don't mean to be mean. It sounds horrible, but... So the thing is, I know I can't please everyone. We're the flock. We're not all in lockstep. You know, we're not little fascist. We're not North Korea. You know what I mean? At all. Israel and North Korea, pretty much opposites, I would say. But, you know, so, like, we know that it's going to be imperfect, but I do want us to, like, be more powerful together. And I'm not aiming for perfection, but... You know, I just want to honor that. Like, you know, the millennial who's the millennial who's telling their parent off, it's no different maybe than when Ziva hits Merav, right? Which we're going through now. So Ziva hits Merav, and Merav hits back, and I tell Merav not to hit back. And Merav says, well, if she hit me, why can't I hit back? And no, I'm not connecting this back to Moses. And I say, she just wants to be close. Ziva only hits you when you're not playing with her, or she feels she doesn't understand the game, or you know, you're not giving her a turn. Like, she only hits you when she wants to be close. In some ways, you know, that's the imperfection of trying to be a community of individuals is that... often we're hurting each other when really what we want is to be close. And so that's, if you can tap into that part, you know, but it's not always easy. I mean, it really isn't. And it's not always just. I mean, I think Shelley was saying, you know, that, I heard you, like, it wasn't right for that person to say it. And I think there is an element of that, which is there is an element of injustice. You know, they're not necessarily helping, you know, with that. And so I do want to honor that. But if you can see in it the desire for some kind of closeness, and it could just be they want closeness with someone who's dead, and they're remembering the Kol Nidre, they're remembering the rabbi from that time in their life that was prodded by the High Holy Days. And I'm never going to be able to give that. I can't give them their Kol Nidre from 1981, you know, with their dad, you know, I can't. But what they're wanting is closeness, you know, and I want to honor that.
Yeah. One more comment.
Let me read you something. So it says, cry with a full throat, raise your voice like a shofar, tell the people of their rebelliousness, their rebellious sin, and so, look, to be sure, I love this. This is a great haftarah. So it says, look, I know, this is God speaking, I know my people seek me daily, and I know my people want to learn my ways. Just make sure. Right, they want to learn my derech, my paths. It's important because tshuva means turning back onto the path. Right? So it's like, I know my people seek me, and I know they want to learn my path so that they do tshuva. They can get on that path. Like a nation that does what is right, that has not abandoned the laws of its God. I want to see that anthill. You know, like, they want to be that anthill. They want to be the nation that lives in a way that I want. And they long to be near God. They say, why, when we fasted, are you not looking, God? We starved our bodies today, but Are you not paying attention? I answer them, because on your fast day, you're thinking about business. And when I look down, I see laborers being oppressed. Because you're fasting, but you're feeling strife and contention. You strike with a wicked fist. You're quick to anger. Your fasting today is not such as to make your voice heard by me on high. Is your fast really the fast I desire, a day for people to starve their bodies? Is it bowing the head like a bulrush, lying in sackcloth and ashes? Do you call that a fast? Do you call that a day when Adonai will be favorable to you? The fast that I desire is this. It's a fast that unlocks the fetters of wickedness, unties the cords of the yoke, that will let the oppressed go free, and breaks off every yoke. It's a fast where you share your bread with the hungry, and you take the wretched poor into your home. And when you see the naked, you clothe them, and do not ignore your own flesh. And then shall your light burst forth like the dawn. And then your healing will happen immediately. And then those who vindicate you will march before you. And I, the very presence of Adonai, will be your rear guard. In Judaism, it's very important that you have a rear guard, because that's where evil attacks. Evil attacks, Amalek attacks from the rear. It attacks the stragglers, the things you're forgetting about. It gets at your weaknesses that you're ignoring. So that's when God said, then I'll be your rear guard. And then when you call, I'll answer. And when you cry out, I'll say, I'm here. If you banish the yoke from your midst and the menacing hand, and if you stop the evil speech, and you offer your compassion to the hungry and satisfy the famished creature, right, human or non-human, then your light will shine in the darkness. And your gloom will give way to noonday. And Adonai will guide you always. I will slake your thirst in your parched places. I love that. You're standing there on Yom Kippur, you know, and you're fasting, and you're thirsty. And it's like, when you're doing that, those parched places in you, you know, they're going to get hydrated. They're going to get their water. They're going to get nourished. It's really beautiful. And I will give strength to your bones. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring whose waters don't fail. And some from your midst will, and some from your remnant will rebuild the ancient ruins. And you will restore foundations that were laid long ago. And you shall be called, you will get a new name, the name of repairer of fallen walls, restorer of lanes for people to live. Remember, Shlomo Carlebach once said, when he was teaching hippies in the Haight-Ashbury district, many of whom were not Jewish, and they're like, dude, why do you have to just keep doing the Jewish teachings? Why don't you just go with the Buddhist teachings and the Eastern teachings and the hippie teachings? And he used to say, you know, when your father's house is burned down, you don't build a new house, you rebuild your father's house. So some from your midst will rebuild the ancient ruins, and you're going to restore foundations laid long ago, and you will get the name repair of fallen walls and the restorers of lanes for people to live on. If you refrain from trampling Shabbat and from pursuing your affairs on my holy day, then Shabbat will really be delight, and a holy day will really be honored. And if you honor it and you go not your ways, nor look to your affairs, nor strike your bargains, then you can seek the favor of Adonai, and I will set you astride the heights of the earth, and you will enjoy the heritage of Jacob. And thus my mouth has spoken.